Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios. What's up, Lance?
How's it going?
I'm well. We are listening to the Erin Deborah Larkin interview. Of course, Erin has been on this show a couple times. She has done this interview with Fred Murray, and she just released part two about a week or two ago. And it's Fred Murray unabashed. Now, before we get into this interview with Fred, which we want to go over a lot of the points that he hits, we just wanted to mention what happened, the reaction to our episode about Israel Keyes that came out last week, episode 72. Mm-hmm. Kind of an interesting reaction. What do you think, Lance?
I thought that people obviously went into it thinking that we were trying to make the connection the direct connection between Keyes and Maura. And what we really wanted people to take from it, and people did take from it, the profiling angle. Early on in our podcast, Maura Murray podcasting careers, we had talked about the odds of a serial killer, an opportunistic killer, and they exist.
Yeah.
And I don't, there's probably no quantifiable odds that you can put on it, because when you look into Keyes's behavior, he didn't let you know that he existed or he was doing that while he was doing it. Even after he was caught, he only told law enforcement as many victims as he could that would put him away, and there's probably more out there. So it's really hard to put a percentage on what we're talking about when he's certainly not the only person who did what he did the way he did it.
Right.
So
yeah, that's the scary part. Yeah.
Right.
And that's what we kind of wanted to touch on. And yeah, it wasn't so much like, did Israel Keyes kill Maura Murray? It was more like, could he have? Yes, I suppose. It's super unlikely, like 0.1% chance based on the things we know, but there is that chance. But more than just Keyes, it was, how many other people out there are like him? And if there's one, there's probably more.
If Maura was abducted, there's a certain type of person that abducted her. And Keyes is a certain type of serial killer. So what we wanted to start the conversation around is, what type of profile is the person who kidnapped Maura if she was kidnapped? Compare that to a very meticulous and calculating serial killer.
Right.
Like Keyes.
Right. Okay, so now that we cleared that up, now something has come up, Lance, before we get into the full bit of this episode. There is a picture that has surfaced from the Oxygen TV show, and someone took a screenshot from the TV show, and it was a picture of Maura at a party, at some kind of social gathering, a few other people around. Everyone else is blurred. You can see Maura there standing, and then there's some writing over the picture. It says, like, Coke dealer, and says, like, green license plate.
Some vague, maybe the name of a street or something, possibly.
Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to explain what this was. The community was in a bit of an uproar earlier this week and last week on Facebook, especially about this picture. Where did it come from? Whose notes are those? So we actually contacted Texas Crew, the production company that produced the disappearance of Maura Murray, and of course that's the TV show that we're talking about that the screenshot was seen on. And we were informed by the guys at Texas Crew that the picture that they got from this investigator did not have the writing on it. The writing was on a separate piece of paper. It was a note. So it was part of this investigator's notes and the picture, and they were two separate things. And this production company, Texas Crew, they put them together. They overlaid the notes on top of the picture to make just a more interesting image for those few seconds it was on screen.
Right. It seems like what most production companies would do. It's not something that, I don't think it's anything that people would be surprised at, that a television production company would superimpose notes over something as sort of a montage-y, transition-y type moment. And from Texas Crew, they said, yeah, we had all of this stuff existed in their research and in their notes. They just put it together in a creative transition montage way.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't invent this this effect, you know, laying over notes over a picture for a true crime show. What they didn't expect or maybe comprehend the largeness of the scale of the community who will take screenshots of this and will try to figure out what it means. And we ran into this with the coordinates that were posted on the TV show too, which weren't the actual coordinates that we went to. So this is the TV show trying to look out for your safety in the coordinates case. In the case with the picture, they're not trying to give you a clue. I promise you, they're not feeding the audience, the people who listen to this show, the viewers of that TV show. I promise you, they're not giving you clues in in pictures like that.
Right. They even told us that they went out of their way to make sure that any other picture, especially this picture and or anything that they put out there on the show, that if there was anyone else in the picture, that they either blurred the face or the back was turned. And that was the case with this picture as well, which you see where they're coming from. And then you see where the Moore Murray community is coming from. And, you can understand both sides. Okay, they want to put this out there for dramatic purposes. And they did, something responsible by blurring faces and making sure the pictures had people with their backs turned. But the community, because they're so passionate about this, now they're trying to figure out who this guy is with his back turned in the picture. And it's about as non-nefarious as it comes, And
yeah.
Both parties are trying to do the responsible thing. So, at least there's an answer now.
Yeah, there's an answer. So moving on, nothing too interesting or important in that picture. So now, Lance, this is the last chance that people have to come to our live show that is coming up this weekend, March 25th, Sunday evening at 6 p.m. in the suburbs of Boston, a city called Somerville, Massachusetts, Davis Square, Somerville, the Rockwell Theater. We are talking to world-renowned and psychic and witch Lori Bruno, who we had on these airwaves in a very controversial episode. I believe it was episode 10, I want to say, alternate method psychics. Mm-hmm. And we went to see her a second time. And what we're about to do this Sunday, we're going to talk to her in a public setting. Link to buy tickets are in our show notes. We're going to talk to her about the case. We're going to talk to her about her life, her ability. But when we talk to her about the case on the live show, we're not going to be bleeping our names like we are in this clip.
You're saying we are not going to be covering up any person of interest, any names associated, which we have done in the past on the episodes, if certain names shouldn't be out there.
Well, listen to this clip right now.
Here, let's see. I got a bunch of pictures of the accident site.
What's this?
That's Butch Atwood's house. He was the bus driver. Who saw her last, supposedly. This is an overhead.
I want to go up there.
Okay.
I want to go up there.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to go up there. Her family, if they call me, sit down with me. Tell them there's no money to get. I want to bring their daughter home. This here is where? What's this thing?
That's house. That's this place right here.
I want to go to all these places.
Yeah. Can I read some names to you?
Yeah. Strange person.
Strange, yeah.
Strange, shifty. Mm. His eyes are shifty. You know him?
No, just heard some rumors about him.
He's a shifty person. Who's the carpenter?
I think that's Forcier.
Who has a speech impediment? His speech is like slurred a little.
I'm not sure. Maybe Tim Carpenter?
Talks with a little slur in his voice.
I think he had a stroke recently.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Is there like a roadhouse, a bar there? Up from there, where she was found? Where she was found. Hello? Hmm. Remember what I just said, where she was found. It's like a roadhouse. Brown color, has sort of red near the windows. She had the boyfriend, but she didn't. She left him.
Mm, yeah.
There was somebody else she met. I'm not kidding you. I see her.
Greg Floyd.
He have a record?
Yeah.
Record?
Yeah.
Prison?
Yeah. I don't know about prison, but yeah.
He's done a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah. Lives pretty close to there.
I get a funny feeling from him. Like a queasy stomach. Greg Floyd. Him, I got a shaky feeling from. Scary little shaky feeling.
Yeah.
Did you know this about him?
Yeah, he's definitely a dangerous guy, yeah.
Weapons. Basement. Yeah. I just got the chills on my back with this one. The others, no, I don't have that. This guy, he's been in trouble since he's a kid, a young teenager. I got a shaky feeling with that man.
Okay, so those names, when we do that with Lori on stage at the Rockwell,
we
on
will
Sunday,
not bleep those out.
Because we can't bleep them.
Because we can't bleep
right, when you talk
a live show.
Right. But when that episode, when the audio airs that we record at the Rockwell on Sunday night,
we're going to have to bleep.
That's going to have to be bleeped.
Listen, psychics exist. Psychics help law enforcement. Law enforcement doesn't necessarily promote this. We don't necessarily promote whether, you know, the belief in psychics.
Right. And you say psychics exist. That doesn't mean that 100% of psychics are real at all. We're not sitting here saying any are real, but we're saying that if any psychic is real, Lori Bruno has that gift. Trust us on that.
Exactly. She's got this energy about her, and she's got an intuition that she can tap into a lot of emotions. And whether or not you're a believer, and we keep saying this over and over, whether or not you're a believer, it's still going to be a fascinating show. I have no idea what she's going to talk about. We have a list of questions and topics, but she'll probably end up going off on her own on her own path, and which is fine, and you know, we'll be along for the ride. But there will be a period of time at the end of our segment where we open it up to the audience and have some questions and answers, and we'll see how long that goes for. And it'll be such a unique opportunity if you are a believer, or if you aren't a believer, or maybe you think you're psychic yourself, or you think you know somebody. It'd be such a unique opportunity to talk to a hereditary high priestess. This woman is entrenched in this.
Yeah. Now we don't claim to that she will give you a reading if you ask a question, but we also can't promise that she won't.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, she's probably not going to field a lot of people coming up to her asking for readings, but again, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
Well, we just got one email today, Lance. This is 100% true. We got this at 11:04 a.m. today from someone named Ashley. The email says, OMG, that woman is totally legit. Subject line is Lori Bruno. She says, just called her for an appointment. She started reading me while we were trying to find a day/time. Wow. See you guys on Sunday.
started giving her the reading while she was just on the phone.
It makes sense. I mean, just watch the footage that we have of Lori. It's totally exactly what she does. I mean, I've talked to her on the phone. It's what she does.
That's what she is.
She actually started doing it to me when I called her, when I spoke with her about the live show a couple days ago.
Oh, yeah, the story about the cat.
Yeah, very odd. Yeah,
crazy.
Which I don't even think I'm the person she was talking about, but I might be. That's how weird it is.
But it makes you think that she's got these things in her brain that are firing kind of all at once, and she hears your name, and then she sees a missing cat poster. Anyway, it's going to be a fantastic show. It's going to be fascinating, and it's, again, a unique opportunity to be in the same room with such a person.
Okay, so tickets in the show notes. Italian-style shrimp and sweet peppers over fregola sarda pasta, Lance.
That sounds delicious. I don't know if you happened to see the picture that I sent out a couple of days ago, pork chops and salsa verde.
Verde is how we say it here, Lance.
With the R roll, the tongue R roll. Verde.
Yeah, of course, okay. We're talking about Blue Apron.
The leading meal kit delivery service in the United States.
Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They have a team of professional chefs putting in a lot of care into creating recipes each week.
And not to mention the flexibility, Blue Apron offers 12 new recipes each week, and customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 based on what best fits their schedule.
That's helpful, Lance, helpful, because if I were to get 4 of these, I don't think I'd be able to make 4 a week without them going bad. So I toggle that down to 2, and it's perfect, Lance. So Blue Apron is treating Missing More Amari listeners to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/missing.
So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/missing.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, let's get into this Fred Murray interview with Erin Deborah Larkin on her podcast, 107 Degrees. So check it out if you haven't heard it, but we will play some clips here, and we just want to talk a little bit about some of these moments.
On that, I just want to thank Erin for being able to interview Fred, for for Julie and the family for, you know, making this happen, and to Fred. He wanted to talk. A lot of people would say, you know, Even Julie said she's working on her dad to, you know, talk to us. And but honestly, he, as long as he talks, and Erin was there, and that's really the most important thing.
Yeah, and he gets this this off his chest, and a lot of it is incredibly fascinating stuff we haven't heard yet. So the Oxygen program mentions the Loon 3. And so so that was one of the things that people took away from the Oxygen show is, who is this Loon 3? Supposedly, this is a group of 3 men. 2 of them are brothers. One of them wasn't. They were all employees at Loon Mountain, as the story goes, of course. And they were they would have traveled down 112, the way Maura was driving, that night to go to work for a night shift. And so they never showed up to work. And so that's the story. We don't even know exactly who these guys are. Fred says they're not the brothers that we thought they were.
Can we say the names? These are names that are out there anyway. We're not accusing anybody of anything. We're just simply saying that it was
the Glynn brothers.
The Glynn brothers.
Yeah.
The rumor was that it was the Glynn brothers. We're not saying that it was or wasn't, but
allegedly it was the Glynn brothers. And Fred has something to say about that truck.
It could be a dirt bag, you know? Traveling dirt bag or something like that from just having going through. We still don't know about the 3 ski workers, the mountain workers, because they weren't the guys that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I always thought that it was the brothers.
The interest in the brothers was because they drove a red truck with the wooden sides and stuff like that. And Robin Ordsway there, or whatever her name was, who was on her way to the log cabin store, saw the truck go by and slow down. You know the story, right? And then they were waiting at the store, and they saw her come around the corner. She obviously wasn't who they were looking for, and they took off. And they've got, I've been told that they're shortwave radio operators, and they've got contact, and they may have heard the police report or something like that, and maybe they're looking for this girl. That was the boys. I tried to get the cops interested in it. Then one day, I was at the accident scene, and this truck went by, and it was the exact truck that it looked like I had heard. This was a description. This was a truck that had been described. This was a very old vehicle.
Okay.
The Glynn boys' vehicle, and the vehicle that Robinson told me about. She kept stressing that it
was old?
Yeah. It had rounded fenders kind of thing, and it was definitely had some years on it. I followed it. It went over and went down the first side street on the left. The boys had rented that house, but I never got a chance to talk to them. I could never bump into them after that.
Yeah.
I couldn't find them. I was there many times up to that place in that house. I searched for them, and I could not find the boys. But that was the connection with the boys, driving by and looking, but nothing at all about going to Loon Mountain.
Wow, okay.
But I'm ruling them out on the Loon Mountain for sure.
Okay, so a couple of things. this means that the Loon 3 is still unidentified. That's interesting to me. It's not the Glynn brothers. There's a couple other brothers that we've heard that it could be. Don't know if it's them. But if you know who this Loon 3 is, please contact us or please contact Fred Murray. The thing about the red truck was always interesting to me as well. This sighting that Robinson Ordway has, she walks to the Swiftwater store and talks to her friend inside and sees this red truck outside, maybe acting suspiciously, turns around, heads back towards the crash site. This all happened after Maura went missing. So the red truck does not have Maura at that time. The only way the red truck was involved is if they somehow located her. Maybe they were looking for her and located her. But then you have to say that these brothers were aware of this party, or you know knew Maura was going to be up there, or perhaps as Fred mentions, they were allegedly had a scanner and were listening to a police scanner and heard about an accident, and who knows?
To say that it happened, so we have to take Ordway's account, eyewitness account, as with as much grain of salt as possible. The description of the truck is very specific, which is really good because, you know, she's not describing a brand new truck. She's describing a truck that has the rounded fenders, and it's, you know, I'm picturing something that's probably like late 70s. So that stands out in her head. Like you said, the timing of it is interesting when you're thinking about it now. Everyone thinks about this red truck like it was looking for Maura, and it mistakes Robinson Ordway as, you know, maybe this could be Maura, but Maura is already gone at that point, which would mean that this truck, like you said, with a scanner, or they drove by in one direction and saw a young woman there, and then they kept going and turned around thinking maybe we can go back. I mean, you're getting into a real, like, sort of sticky situation with, is this somebody who just decided to seize an opportunity?
If this was the guys and they were looking for this account that they heard on the scanner and they saw Robinson Ordway, unless they recognized her, they wouldn't have known that it wasn't the woman from the car. So they saw her and seemed to have decided this isn't our target for whatever reason. If this is an opportunistic truck driving around, they didn't take the opportunity with her.
You're saying, yeah, exactly. You're saying they didn't take the opportunity with somebody who was walking by themselves anyway.
So either they were looking for Maura specifically because of plans that they had with her, or this is completely unrelated.
I want to throw out a wild concept as well. The Loon 3 not going to work the next day, what if that's not even true?
I mean, we haven't really been able to substantiate
one
the claim anyway.
Right.
It's a local rumor at this point, basically. And Erin has an idea on who she thinks started the rumor, but we can't get confirmation on that. We are actively trying to, and she is too.
I feel like I'm stumbling around with these concepts once again, and it's sort of, in a weird way, exhilarating to get right back into the minutiae of it. Because of Ordway's memory of the truck being like specifically an older truck, and she doesn't know about what's happening up the road. She remembers the truck, and then she remembers the truck stopping at the store. And it's probably suspicious in retrospect when she finds out what's happened up the road. But during that time, is it really? I mean, we've driven the 112 before, and if you come around a corner and you see somebody walking on the street right there, you're probably going to slow down and you're going to go by, and it's a small town, so maybe this person goes by and checks to see if this is somebody that they know, and then the next thing that's up ahead is the store. So it could have been somebody just on the way to the store.
I'm telling you, this can't look at me at all, and he's that guy is suspicious, and that's the prime name that I get hit with all the time for years and years early. That was overwhelming finger pointing by locals. There was a tale of in a bar in Franconia with there, and they were discussing Maura, you know, and the report was that they did it. I know that, but I got stuff like that all over the place, and it was always these guys. Those are well-known, renowned local dirtbags, and there's no way around that. And it gets right down to her being seen in the back seat of a car with two of the and maybe at where the sighting was supposed to take place at 116 and 112. Who knows? You know, what's true and what's not. But I've never been able to put it to bed. The whole first 5 years, I did nothing but chase these guys. I went to all these guys by myself. And they're yards. I never brought anybody with me or anything like that. And I just confronted them. I confronted in his driveway. He said, I knew you were coming. I didn't do it. I don't know why they don't jump all over when you see where he lives and where Mara was. And there's a blue backpack that looks like hers, could be hers, up in the woods behind his road, you know. And they don't talk to him. So I didn't like that.
He also talked about local dirt bags, which I found really fascinating. He talked about Rick, and Aaron bleeps some of the names, but I'm pretty sure he confronts Rick in his driveway, and Rick says, "I knew you were coming. I didn't do it," which is pretty interesting. He knew he was coming, you know.
He was expecting him,
right? Right. And then just Fred. The fact that Fred does this at all is Jesus, I don't even know what to call it. It's ballsy. It's
He also says that police didn't contact the people in that area for mm-hmm. 10 days. Is he talking about the people in the immediate area? The Westmans, the Marats, the Atwoods?
Well, he's not talking about the Westmans. He might be talking about the Marats. Wouldn't be talking about the Atwoods either, or at least Butch.
Or is he talking about the general area?
Yeah, I'm not sure. He doesn't really specify who he's talking about.
Yeah, I just had that. That was just a question.
Speaking of local dirtbags, he also mentions Floyd, Greg Floyd, who we talked about with Chris King on this podcast, episode 69, who was involved in this crazy gunfight, is the only way you can really call it, the only description you can use. Check out episode 69 for a breakdown of that. We also do it or talk about that moment in episode 41, Showdown in Franconia. But basically, Greg Floyd shoots a man who shot a cop. And he happened to live only a few miles away from the crash site, and lives very close to where neighbor Rick said he saw Mora, his sighting. You know, I'll use air quotes, his sighting, because we don't know if it's real or not. But wherever neighbor Rick put Mora in that sighting, it was very close to Floyd's house. So Fred says, I don't know why they haven't questioned Floyd more thoroughly.
And he also indicates that there was a blue backpack that was found on Floyd's property that they never properly investigated.
Right. I'm confused about that, too, because I thought there was a black backpack that Mora had. So I'm slightly confused about that detail.
Could possibly be that the colors were lost in you know,
time,
the annals of time.
Yeah, faded.
Yeah. Blue backpack. You know, purple backpack, you know, black backpack.
Navy blue.
Exactly.
Okay.
Where all that goes is just such a friggin' mystery.
Yeah.
Like again, getting sort of weirdly exhilarated by talking about the minutiae here. I hear Fred say these things about a backpack and Greg Floyd, and then you just think about this whirlpool of just bad characters in that area and the perfect storm of bad people that she got into the accident in front of.
Yeah. And he mentions as such. Okay, and here is a clip where Fred is talking about his relations with the police.
The program accepted the police whitewashing themselves way too easily. That interview with the police turned my stomach, especially the one with Cecil, with them snickering about the whole squad business. And then Baby Huey, I call him, Williams, comes on and denies everything. But it seems scripted to me, you know? They were coached. You see Coach Strelzin sitting there glaring at them. But it did me good to force Monahan to make a public appearance, even though he said it absolutely as little as possible. But no follow-up on why did you not go east. None. Everybody else went west, Monahan. Nobody went east, and it's your road. It's a state-patrolled, a state highway. That means the state police patrol it. We know that because further down on 112, when Julie and Mara and I were camping on Jigga Johnson Campground on 112, the state police were going by all the time. They'd come in the campground. It's their route. It's their beat. So he didn't, on a missing girl, he doesn't go on his beat. He reverses back and goes, whatever the Christ he says he did. Who knows what he did? Only he knows what he did. No one else. His own department doesn't know what he did. Strelson doesn't know what he did. No one knows what he did that night. And they never will. Only Monahan knows what he did, and possibly Mara. But I don't accept that, that he didn't go east. If he didn't go east, he's the worst cop in the history of the world. You know? But he I think he did go east. He says he didn't, but he should have. And I right from the very beginning, I said, if I can't get my daughter back, I want the world to know that this cop had an opportunity. This cop was my daughter's last only hope. The only chance she had of getting out of this was if the cop went down and saved it. And so she's not subject to whatever dirtbag rolls by, and there are plenty. And so that's maybe the best thing that happened with the program. It gave me and afforded me an opportunity to point out to the world what has been hushed up all this time. And that's probably the thing I wanted to do most about the program, probably the reason I did it. I want Monahan exposed as being the worst cop or a suspect. That's how what I consider him. He didn't look for her. That's what he says. Why? What's your job, mister? You know? This is Monahan. This is a guy that didn't look for my missing daughter who's now gone, dead. This is a guy that could have saved her and didn't, unless he killed her. That's what I've got to say. That is not off the table. I'm still saying it. I know it's a heavy load to put on someone, but he deserves it. Especially if he did it.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there, Lance. Fred is talking about John Monahan, and it's very jaw-dropping.
He's going back and forth between calling Monahan a potential suspect and, you know, at the worst, calling him a murderer, and at the best, calling him the worst police officer he's ever experienced in his life.
Right, yeah.
Because he didn't go in the direction that he thought he should have gone in, which was east.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else was going west, and he was curious why he didn't go east. And just to be clear, east is in the direction of Bradley Hill and Butch Atwood, and I think the town line there is Bath, like right there around the corner, like over that hill.
Coach Strelzin, I thought was kind of funny, actually, and interesting. I mean, so he talks about the oxygen program and how Coach Strelzin, is what he said, was sitting there and was coaching John Monahan and Jeff Williams and Cecil Smith. And I don't know if that's fair. I don't know what it is, but he's making a point here. He says that he's very happy that the Oxygen show got Monahan and some others to talk, but
he said it felt scripted to him,
right,
and coached.
And Monahan has never talked otherwise, never talked to Fred, never talked to publicly about this. So, I mean, that's when you boil that clip down, I think that's the part that I'm very confused about. Why not? What is he protecting? And Aaron says, well, it must be for legal reasons. Well, what's the legal reason? I can't really, I'm not any kind of lawyer, know anything about the legal justice system, but
the only thing I can think of is if he was part of a grand jury and he doesn't want to tell Fred something that would go against what he told a grand jury.
But if he saw something and testified at a grand jury, that would mean that he saw something.
Well, no, you can get called before a grand jury and simply say, this is what happened, and he didn't see anything.
If he didn't see anything, then wouldn't he just say, I didn't see anything?
To Fred or to the grand jury?
To Fred.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Right. So this is, I'm trying to untangle the cobwebs around like what your confusion is,
yeah,
and make the listeners see what your confusion is. If it's A, then it should be A. If it's not A, then it's going to be something else.
Right.
Right. If he testifies again with a grand jury and he didn't see anything, and he doesn't, you know, what's the harm in telling the woman's father that I didn't see anything?
I don't know. And he's a public servant. He's the chief of Franconia right now, as you know, currently.
Right.
So, I mean, and Fred mentions he's been in Franconia. He's never seen him. I don't know. I mean, that's just one of those things. I mean, we'd love to put the invite out to him, out to all these guys. We'd love to put the invite out to John Monahan and Jeff Williams and Cecil Smith and Jeff Strelz and anyone who wants to talk about this, you know, and respond. I mean, this is a good question. This is one of the community's main questions is why didn't Monahan go east?
When I first heard this, when I first heard Fred talking about Monahan, you know, I gave you a look. You and I were giving each other looks like, I can't believe he's saying this about Monahan. But he's really doing, Fred is really doing what we've been doing for the past, 70 episodes, 71 episodes, which is like, just keep talking. Just keep talking about it. And Fred is, and he said, you know, he says, I understand, like, he didn't say it in so many words. He said he understood the gravity of what he was saying, which was, you know, calling the current chief of the Franconia police, calling him the worst police officer that he's ever seen at best, or a suspect in a murder. Now, this is Fred just throwing anything against the wall to see what sticks. Who knows if he believes that, right? But what he is doing is he just keeps talking about it. He keeps talking about it. And the worst thing that'll happen is Moynihan comes back to him and says, okay, fine, here, this is what I said. Let's talk.
Yeah.
And again, that's just me trying to pull away some of the cobwebs. I might not be doing the best job of it, but it goes back to this confusion. Everyone else is talking about it. Everyone else is talking about it. Everyone else is begging for just a little clarification.
Yeah.
But and
if he said nothing at the grand jury, he can say nothing now. If he said something at the grand jury, he can say nothing now.
He could simply say.
But then the question is, he said something at the grand jury.
Right.
And then, you know, what did he say?
The answer could be, I just don't understand why the answer couldn't be from him or any other member of law enforcement. Listen, I testified in front of a grand jury, so I can't say anything, and that's why I'm not saying anything.
And we know there
we have to leave it at that.
Right. And then, we know there was at least a grand jury. We know there was actually several grand juries. Or two, at least two. I don't know how many he testified at. Why would he testify at any if he didn't see anything?
I suppose you're called before a grand jury if you are a state trooper and that's your district. You know, like you said, that was his beat. So, and he was part of it. He was
on the scene.
He was on the scene. So it just, that makes sense.
Okay.
But I mean, when he first started talking about him, I thought he was being incredibly hard on him. And then I remembered the conversations that we've been having about what to do with, you know, is there no protocol for abandoned cars? Oh, there's so many abandoned cars out there. What are you supposed to do? Well, aren't you going to do anything? Like, it doesn't mean that you are going to be why are you so, like, complacent? Just because there's no protocol doesn't mean you have to be completely goddamn complacent about things. There's a car. Someone said there was a young woman. She's not there. So what do you just say? That's just show up. Like, I could see what, you know, I was very critical about what Fred said about Moynihan. And now, you know, talking about it, do your job.
Ugh, I'm so tired, Lance. We need help.
I can barely hear you in this pile of papers that I'm shuffling through.
Ugh, God, there's just so much to do. We need to hire someone, Lance. Where do we start?
Every business, including ours, needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right person to see it.
And ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job, Lance.
What I've learned after talking about ZipRecruiter is 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through their site in just one day.
What? That's crazy. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free.
For what?
For free, Lance. We made this incredible deal with ZipRecruiter. We talked to them, and we hashed it out, and it wasn't easy. And they said, okay, you can have it for free.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time in that dark room with ZipRecruiter's associates. We were going over this, and we said, our listeners need this. So just go to ZipRecruiter.com/MMM.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/MMM.
That was like a six-hour meeting we had with them. So please, ZipRecruiter.com/MMM.
ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
There are people watching all this time, you know, at that 100-meter mark where the program maintains she got in a car. I'm sitting here saying Maura would have fought and run. You're not going to catch her. She'd have to be surprised or something like that. She'd have to voluntarily get in the car or something like that. And nobody saw it. And there were three people who were off and on. But this is right in front of Butcher's house. And Butcher's only in the house the shortest possible time. And either Butch isn't talking or Butch maybe saw a cop grabber or something like that. And people don't talk to other people. They don't report things. They mind their own business. You have to drag information out of them. They're not going to volunteer stuff. And it just makes it that much harder. People are afraid to come forward.
Okay, so Fred starts talking about how people were watching. People were watching, and Maura would have fought and run or got into a car voluntarily. She wouldn't have gotten pulled into a car. People were watching. He says he, you know, calls out the Westmans. You know, why aren't they talking? He calls out one of the other neighbors being on a message board and sounding somewhat anti-Maura Murray, as is saying there's too much attention in this area now.
Also saying that if Butch had seen something, he would have said something, or if he'd, I think we were wondering why would Fred specifically mention, you know, unless Butch saw a cop.
Right.
Taker. And I think you're just trying to narrow down why someone like Butch wouldn't say something. So it would have to be somebody that he has, you know, has influence over him, and a police officer, I guess, would have influence over him.
Right. So I could see why Fred said that. But it could also be a number of other local dirtbags up there that Butch might have known about if he didn't know directly.
And Butch does say that he saw several cars pass by when he was standing on the porch.
Yeah.
But he didn't see any person walking.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think it's a good point. Someone, how many eyeballs were on the scene, and no one has said anything? No one saw anything? Really? Are we really trying to believe that right now? No one saw anything?
Right? This is a question that we've been asking since we started this. How is it possible that in this area that, you know, a mile in either direction or a half mile in either direction, and there's no houses, you know, there's less eyeballs on it. Everybody's home where she crashes, and not walking into the woods. I mean, we talk about the scent dogs, and if that was a legitimate lead, if properly investigated with the whole like new gloves versus any old piece of clothing that they could have gotten out of her car or item of whatever with the scent. But it, regardless. They lost her scent. She didn't just fly up in the air.
Right. And yeah, and Fred says he doesn't believe she got into a car.
Unless she was pulled into a car. But if she was she would have put up a fight.
Right. And so in that case, I guess he's not ruling that out. He's just saying someone would have seen it. And which we're back at the beginning of this conversation again, is someone had to have seen or heard something.
Unless
right?
there's another alternative that we're not even considering because we haven't thought about.
That she just got involuntarily and everyone looked away at that moment.
No, I mean something that we haven't even talked about, that we haven't even thought of, that I don't even know, you know? Was she, did someone accidentally hit her? We don't really talk about that.
Well, we've talked about that.
But we don't like talk about it ad nauseum the way we talk about.
Because there's no facts to support it.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's no reports of a loud thud like that could be attributed to that. There's no blood on the street, no skid marks.
When would that have happened?
Yeah.
When Butch wasn't looking, when Faith hung up after or before.
I think we're saying.
When Say showed up.
Yeah, exactly.
When would that all happen?
I think we're saying if that happened, someone saw it and isn't saying it. And if she was pulled into a car, someone saw it or heard it and didn't say anything. The only thing that could be possible that everyone's still telling the truth is that she got into a car voluntarily and no one saw it.
Yeah. Right. And so then go to the scenarios around that. Like, why would she get into a car voluntarily? She knew the person or she trusted the person.
Or she knew the police were on their way and she knew she was going to get a ticket or get arrested for perhaps having an open container in the car.
Yeah.
Here we are back at episode one.
Exactly. Here we are back at episode one. I mean, you could... You can talk yourself, and we have done that. You can talk yourself into circles on this.
We just did.
I mean, you're talking about a young woman who probably was drinking, was probably buzzed. I don't want to go so far as to say drunk.
At the very least, she probably had an open container, we can say.
Right. And she also had an airbag just go off in her face.
Yeah.
So she was one could assume she was disoriented. And by the time Butch left and she had a chance to gather her thoughts and maybe get, you know, breathe in some air and collect herself, maybe she was thinking, oh, well, maybe I should take off from this car for a little bit. But if what Butch is saying is true, she knows that Butch is about to call the police because he says that.
Right. Yeah.
So what would if a smart person like Maura doesn't want the police to be called and does want to call AAA?
She locks her car and tries to get away from the scene for a little while.
Or she walks in the direction of the guy that just told her he was going to call the police.
Yeah.
And it would make sense to me for her to consider going to what looks like a pretty like warm, inviting home and A, preventing him from using the phone by saying, I'm just going to call AAA. That seems like something that's logical to me.
It does. I know. It's
and then when you put that with like where the radius was, where the dogs lost the scent or allegedly lost the scent, we have no reason to believe that they didn't lose the scent right there on the corner of Bradley Hill. If you're looking at that scenario where she's walking in that direction, so who picks her up and when? Forcier wasn't home. Well, didn't see anything.
Well, we're going to get into that in a different episode because he's got some different accounts out there. So we're going to focus pretty much a whole episode on his accounts.
And what we don't want to do, I apologize if I just got started on doing it, is we don't need to create more what ifs. But I guess at some point you do need to say what if, as long as you know that what if should be checked off the list. You know, it's not a what if to just put more ideas out there and create, you know, more scenarios for the family and for the people looking into this.
Here's a good one. Fred talked to James Conrad. James Conrad is a former New Hampshire State Police trooper who took to the Maura Murray official family Facebook page back in August of 2015 and said that the state police know where Maura Murray's body is and it's buried under one of the suspect's houses or the suspect's house. And then he subsequently deleted those from the Facebook page and he went off the grid. We had tried to reach him. I remember talking to the Texas Crew Production Company and we stressed to them, look, track this guy down because
it was really soon, like it was real fresh at
that
point.
Also because this guy is former law enforcement, he's seen behind the blue curtain and he has a theory or he has some take. He says the police know what it is, so I wanted to hear what the heck that was, and we couldn't get in touch with him. And so it turns out Fred Murray spoke with James Conrad,
he said about 3 years ago,
about after it happened,
yeah,
after he posted. But unfortunately, he said that James really didn't know anything. He said it was nothing, and it was just his opinion.
Have you tried to talk to James Conrad? He's the guy who's a state trooper.
Yes, I did, and I got nothing. He said, I don't really have anything, Fred. This is what I think. This is stuff I've heard. But I did talk to him, and he kind of discouraged me from pursuing it, saying that he didn't really have anything that I could use directly.
Hmm. Did you talk to him like a long time ago, or was that more recent?
No, probably 3 years tops.
Okay.
Because that's when he resurfaced.
Yeah.
At that point, that's when I talked.
So this does sort of sound to me like someone who had an axe to grind. We know he had an axe to grind with the state police at the time, and he just wasn't ready for the repercussions that happened when he posted this on Facebook. And that should, you know, that was a red flag to us when we saw, well, why would he be posting it on Facebook? Well, maybe he's doing it because he wants, you know, more eyes on it.
Okay, but he says it's his opinion, so he believes it. It's not like he's going there to just talk smack. He actually believes it.
It sounds like a backpedaling way of saying like, hey, I just put my opinion out there.
He didn't want to go into it any further and take it up with, like, he didn't want to, like, Fred get possessed and go, you know, and talk to the police about this and bring it up. And Conrad was probably afraid he was going to get sued for saying anything at all. But he does say it's his opinion. So it was his opinion. It is what he believed to be true.
Where that comes from, I don't know. I mean, you could really say that it was his opinion because he had an axe to grind and it was such a high profile case. This was a way where he could make the state police look really bad. And then the next thing he knows, he's talking to Fred Murray and he has to say, listen, it's just my opinion. Don't take this any further, because he might have been approached by the state police you know, is there internal affairs? I don't know. Like,
sure, but okay, so if he was behind, he was part of this investigation, or he was working with the police during this time, we know that the police pulled over the trailer after Rick Forcier sold it. We know that they searched his property after he sold his house. Mm-hmm. So we can assume, I think, that that was who he was talking about. And I think that's safe to assume that that is his opinion, that Moore is still on that property.
And that is a good segue for the episode that we get into it a little bit deeper.
Yeah. Okay, moving on for now.
But that was a good segue.
A good primer. And then there's another part where John Healy's name comes up, and he is an investigator. He's a former police officer. He worked on the Moore Murray case as a private investigator in the years after the disappearance. He did a lot of work, talked to Butch Atwood's wife in Florida, I believe, and was part of, even though he wasn't present for, the A-frame search.
So John Healy, I've read a couple of statements that he put out, and they're all so sort of cryptic. He never really explains what is behind what he's saying. So one of the things he said was that we discovered several anomalies and we forwarded them all to the state police, but wouldn't obviously reveal them. Do you know like what his line of thinking was?
He didn't tell me. And he didn't tell me that he found anything. If he found something, he didn't tell me. And he also didn't tell me I found something, but I can't tell you. He didn't say anything about finding anything, any evidence or anything like that. That his major thrust, and I can't emphasize it enough. It was he really put a rush on me twice to keep me from going to court. He did his absolute flat-out best to keep me from going to court and asking for records.
What I found interesting is that Healy says that he turned over info he found to the New Hampshire State Police, and Fred doesn't even know what that is today. What is that? Why would he not tell Fred?
I don't know. There's been a lot of things about John Healy that we have been finding out in the years that we've started, you know, hearing his name come up, and his name came up in a way where he was, you know, this private investigator and he was leading the charge and they were going into the A-frame house. And then we find this detail that he was never in the A-frame house and he wasn't the one that handed over the carpet sample and he doesn't know where it is. So who knows? Maybe John Healy isn't far off from other private investigators that we've dealt with in the past that just kind of prove to not know where certain ravines are.
Well, I think you might be right. He also was pretty critical of the Oxygen documentary. And
after the fact.
Maybe it was during it was airing.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
He took to his own Facebook page and wrote, quote, unquote, documentary, like, you know, and badmouthed it. But I don't like that. So to your point about maybe, he doesn't have all his ducks in a row, to quote, unquote, documentary is factually incorrect. It was a documentary. So you can start there with him.
Right. Yeah, you can start there with him. It's always funny to me how these people are critical of the series, you know, while it's being aired after they had the opportunity to be a part of it, and then they don't be a part of it. And their whole playbook of 14 years of no answers seems to be the one to go by. And then the series comes out and it's not, you know, it's quote, you put quotes around documentary. Well, if you have information, sir, provide it.
Yeah, there are people trying to find answers here.
Right. There was a major production and major work that went into this, and people still work on this, like Art and Maggie still work on this, and they're devoting so much time to it. If you have this information that can take the quotes off of the documentary word that you wrote, like, if you, please provide it to Art so he can provide it to Chuck West and they can move it up the chain.
Well, my critique of someone critiquing the Oxygen show is, what do you wanted the case to say the same? Like, something had to change. To your point and to his point and other investigators' point, nothing's happened in 14 years. Well, you have to shake things up sometimes for movement to happen, and that was the purpose of the Oxygen show.
As one of the elements of the Oxygen show.
Yeah.
Exactly. No one said that it was going to be solved. And to use the sports analogy like we use with the playbook, If you're a sports franchise and for 14 years you haven't won anything, then you change your playbook. You change the structure. You look at how other things are done and you try to match that.
That's the complacent handbook, is to, you know, complain that nothing's happened in 14 years and to not participate in this new move, you know, this new thing that's actually trying to shake things up.
And it's a lot easier to slip into the whole, well, please don't share anything with us. And, you know, I haven't heard anything. John Healy sends stuff to the New Hampshire State Police and he doesn't hear back.
Right.
And, you know,
he also tried to talk Fred out of suing the police, it sounds. That was what Fred said, so. If you're a fan of Missing Maura Murray, you probably love true crime. And if so, let me tell you about a new podcast that we love. So, Lance, when you think of a criminal, what do you picture? Do you picture a murderer, a gangster, a thief? Do you picture a woman?
Probably not. No, I'm not picturing a woman. And Tim, it's funny you bring this up because that's why I'm hooked on this new podcast, Female Criminals. Have you heard of this?
I have.
Every week, the hosts of Female Criminals, and they're great, they take a psychological approach to analyzing the stories and the motivations of the women behind some of the world's most dangerous crimes.
Each episode analyzes the psychology of these criminals, looking into their minds to better understand their motives. The hosts dive deep into the lives of infamous female criminals, providing listeners with each woman's backstory and details of her crimes.
I want to just highlight the cocaine goddess.
New episodes come out every Wednesday, and they're going to cover Eileen Wuornos soon, Lance, of course.
Monster.
Yeah, of course. So visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Female Criminals. Again, that's FemaleCriminals. Did I spell that correctly?
I think you did. Either way, it's Female Criminals, or you visit Parcast.com/criminals to start listening now.
That's Parcast, Parcast.com/criminals to listen now. How did the police know it was Maura Murray in the car? Question we keep coming back to, question that Aaron raises to Fred here. Fred doesn't really have an answer.
So in the dispatch logs, the earliest it appears that they knew it was Maura was around noon the next day. So I'm curious as to when they contacted either Kathleen, because I think Kathleen was the first person that they contacted or the first person that they talked to.
Two in the afternoon, late.
Late.
Yeah, maybe 4 o'clock or so. Kathleen called me. I found out about 5 when I got out of work in Connecticut. I was sitting in the parking garage. And that's when I saw a message, and it was Kathleen. And Dad, Maura's gone. And I found her car. So they had must have contacted her late in the afternoon, as I see it.
So they never told you how they knew it was her?
Told me? No.
Because the car is registered to you.
Yes. That's why they're trying to get in touch with me. When did they actually know there was a girl? Now, didn't Cecil go up to the house and say, where is the girl?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what was reported. I don't know if it's true.
Well, he must have talked to Butch. Mm-hmm. And Butch must have told Cecil there was a girl.
Right.
And so then he went down and talked to the lady in the corner, Westman's or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so he would have known after talking to Butch that it was a girl. So he knew Monday night that it was a girl.
Right.
When they knew it was Maura, I don't know.
So one of the other things in the dispatch log is that they said that her height was 5'7", but Butch Atwood said it was 5'5". They gave two different heights.
It was closer to 5'7".
Yeah, it was, well, at least on all the posters it says 5'7", so I'm assuming that's what was on her license. So how did they know her name and her height?
I know, I'm cloudy in that. When did they know that it was actually Maura Murray?
Yeah, as opposed to, like, Julie driving the car, or Kathleen.
Well, just some girl. Where was the girl? The girl driving it. So they ran the place, found it was me.
And that's, like, in the dispatch log, it says your name.
And what's the first mention of Maura?
The next day, they put out the bolo around noon, and that's when they say Maura Murray. So they had to have figured it out in the meantime.
How did they know it was Maura, not Julie or Kathleen? I don't know that.
Was she maybe listed as a driver on your insurance?
I think I took her off my insurance because it cost me more money and she wasn't going to drive that car,
right.
You know? And that the reason that the car was covered was I had reached a maximum. There was some reason that I didn't understand. But for some technical reason, I was covered.
So that's something we should, if it's possible to track down, would be interesting. Because that's the only way I can figure that they would know. And I can also try to find out if it's customary to run people's insurance. I don't know if it is. But that's the only logical explanation I can figure.
Yeah, because if it isn't that, what could it be? You know, if they had it at noontime.
Either that or they're making a huge assumption, which is, I don't think that they could do that.
No, there's no way of knowing which Fred's got three daughters. How are they even going to know that?
So Fred's name was on the registration.
Car was registered to him.
Right. We know that.
Yep.
The police did get into the car that night.
And we know that because we know that her belongings were outside of the car when Fred was shown the car. So we know that at some point they got into the car.
Right. So the car, Maura locked the car, theoretically. Maura locked the car. The cops unlocked it, went through some of her belongings. Fred got there a couple days later, started the car, got his key from under the car, as he says in the interview, and starts the car. Car starts. But yes, the police had been inside the car.
We have the eyewitness accounts that it's a young woman.
Right.
And we have Butch give the most detailed of the eyewitness accounts.
Yep.
So we can, I would hope, could assume that police get into the car that night, find Fred's name on some document, whether it's insurance or the registration, and find Maura's name on textbooks or...
She had a parking sticker also on her car, UMass parking sticker.
So they find textbooks, parking sticker, and at some point put it together that this is based on, you know, maybe seeing her name on a textbook or something that would have her name and last name.
But they're not positive, though. So we're saying that before they put the Be On The Lookout out, they're not positive it was Maura. I mean, I guess that you can't, even if you're law enforcement today, sitting here in 2018, I suppose you can't be positive it was Maura Murray now. So when they put that Be On The Lookout out, yeah, they would have had to have not been positive that it was Maura Murray because we still aren't sure.
That's correct.
Okay. Another one, it's tough to talk about because it feels like you're talking in circles.
Right. Something that Fred brought up, which I felt was a really good question that I'm not sure if we've talked about before, but are we positive that Smith went to Butch's house first and then to the Westman's house?
I'm not positive, but that is what Fred says in the interview. Aaron asks, why did Smith say to the Westman's, where's the girl? How would he have known, I think, is the implication. And so Fred says he talked to Butch first, but that is a curious point.
Why would he walk 100 or so yards up the street to Butch's house when there's a house right across the street? So what I'm thinking is because the Westmans were on the phone at the time and Faith describes to the dispatcher on the phone that there's a female outside and she sees the flurry of activity at the trunk, Smith says to her, where's the girl? I don't know if that specifically came from his interaction with Butch or maybe it was just the information he was given from her through dispatch.
Right. Could be anything.
It's an interesting question, though.
How did they know it was Maura?
Exactly.
Is the question.
And,
yeah.
And exactly when.
So the Oxygen series, well, their timeline actually just doesn't work.
I agree with you.
That was sort of a blaring mistake. But but I think their time for her was 7:37, and that's the latest possible that she could have gone by the scene, is according to my calculations, because at that point, at 7:37, she was still 12 miles over the speed limit.
Okay, and 7:52 was the call?
Yeah.
And that's inviolate. That's
yes.
That's a fact, right, in the true sense of the term. So his crap doesn't work because he got there at 7:46.
Right. Yeah, my estimation was that she passed the scene around 7:33, 7:34.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope she doesn't back off.
Yeah.
So right there, that's the major crux of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tearing that apart, it should totally reopen the case. In my mind,
because there's just no way.
So I want that discussed. I don't want the program to be able to say, well, that's that. If Cecil was in a sedan, we got a whole different ball game going here.
Was that the first time you'd heard about the SUV? Or him driving the SUV? The first explanation from the police?
I never knew what car was involved. I heard it kind of both ways, you know? So I don't know. I never did know.
But they never, like, came out and just said he was driving the SUV?
I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to that type of stuff. I'm looking for my daughter's supposed to be here. She's not. Where is she? I spent 100% of my time chasing where my daughter was. If it wasn't directly important to that, I didn't pay any attention because I had other people paying all kinds of attention to that.
Also, Fred and Aaron start talking about the timeline, and they mention Witness A and things like that. And Fred doesn't want this to be left alone. He wants people to keep talking about this. And Aaron mentions the timeline from the Oxygen show is not accurate, or at least doesn't make sense to her. Now, Lance, as you know, and maybe some others know, this is sort of like a thing that's been going on since the Oxygen show, behind the scenes, sort of been talked about ad nauseum. So we're going to dedicate a whole separate episode to the timeline.
Right. What we did here today was we unintentionally talked ourselves into these rabbit holes again. We went on for a little bit longer than we intended to. And the timeline is a much bigger conversation. And in order to properly address it, we should be reaching out to the people that create the timeline, and we should be comparing it to what Aaron's talking about, to the dispatch log, and really present like a solid response to what we just heard with Aaron and Fred.
Yeah, because we know the community still has a lot of questions about this timeline, and it would be just easy for us to just let it go, but here we are, conduits of the community, and so it's our obligation, Lance.
And please don't let the timeline be something that is like upsetting for anybody. So people get fired up about the timeline, you know, oh, can't you let it go? Or why don't they pay attention to it more? The timeline is really important, and there is something there. Obviously there's something there because she went missing in that time. So the more attention that we place on it, the better. Mm. And if something's not fitting someone's timeline, we should try to work it out the best we can.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. Another one was when Fred started talking about Sharon Rausch and the Rausches and how they're salt of the earth.
Like Mrs. Rausch, she was invaluable and highly organized, and she had everything. She lost all her notes. We had to go to, I don't know, someplace that we had to fly there and do a program, and she was flying in from Ohio, and they lost her baggage, and she lost all her notes, and she was the original note taker. If I didn't, and the Wells River Motel sitting there beside me taking notes. She was there for a long time, and Bill Rausch was there, and Bill Sr. They gave me an awful lot of help. Really nice people. Salt of the earth, nice.
The airline lost the luggage with all her notes in it.
So we were talking sort of behind, while we were listening to it, it was a little behind the scenes type stuff, but that sounds like a reasonable excuse on the surface, right? But if you've lost your luggage, you look for your luggage. If I didn't have notes for my son's fiance, her disappearance, if I didn't have those notes, I'd still look for my luggage until I could absolutely find my luggage. Or I got reimbursed by the airline for what was in there. But the fact is that Sharon had notes from her son's fiance's disappearance in those luggage. So what we came to conclude was that either the luggage was stolen or... What's the conclusion?
Well, usually if luggage doesn't go to where it's supposed to go, it gets sent somewhere else to some other city.
And it's stored.
Well, then it would go around the carousel and no one would claim it.
Right.
And then it would be stored. So either someone said, oh, that's a nice suitcase, I'm just going to take that, and they took it and that's it. Or it was stored somewhere and never somehow returned to Sharon Rausch.
So there's your scenarios. One person is out there right now with a bunch of notes about Maura's disappearance. If you're out there and you're listening to this, it'd be really cool to get those notes back, and we'd appreciate that a lot, and I'm sure the family and law enforcement would. Or it's still sitting somewhere in some storage lock. I mean, how long do they keep them? Do they toss it?
They have to exist somewhere. The suitcase wasn't on Malaysia Flight 370, Lance.
But that's something that feels like, you know, why are you talking about so, you know, I can imagine people listening to this and thinking, why are they talking about this so intensely? But it's one of those details that shouldn't be lost in the mix. It shouldn't fall through the cracks, because Fred just said that this woman was instrumental. They divided up duties. His was to go through the woods and knock on doors. Her duty was to take notes, and these notes are gone forever, but they're not.
I mean, they existed at one point. They don't not exist now.
Right. If someone took the wrong luggage, then you've found notes for a missing woman. And if you still have it, that'd be awesome to get back.
Okay, and here is Fred in an emotional clip.
I went to Jigger Johnson, and that's the campground that the girls and I and my son and the family would go to every single year. And I went there, and that's when it kind of got to me pretty bad. You can burn on anger and borderline hate for a long time. You can burn on it, you know, and it keeps the reality from sinking in, because when it sinks in, it's going to knock the living crap out of me, you know. And I'm good at that. I stay busy trying to blast through it. But when I went to Jigger Johnson, I said the Jigger Johnson visit is too much. It just all come flooding back in. I had no defenses, and you know, this is our spot. It was our spot, you know, for the kids and myself. And that was tough. I don't think I can go back, because you have to almost have this happen to you to fully get any kind of appreciation for what it feels like. Well, anyway, what's the other got here? Can't rule out police cover-up. I don't need to put that in there, but... Oh, God.
It's really tough to listen to.
It's tough to listen to, but he defines himself in that clip, in the transition between you can burn on anger and I could do everything in my power to look for Maura and just push through. But when he went to Jigger Johnson Campground, and that was where he was, you know, most familiar with the family and his kids, and it starts to get the better of him. He couldn't do it. And then you pointed out, he's shuffling papers. He's letting it get to him, and then he goes right back to the, you know, well, there could be this, there could be this, it could be conspiracy. There's things that need to be checked off the list. So he defined himself in that, you know, 30-second transition.
He says it, too, a little later, that, you know, his role now in this whole thing is putting pressure on the police, and that's it. He says...
You see me, I'm a one-trick pony.
Yeah, he urges Aaron and Julie to carry the torch, essentially, and the rest of this community to kind of carry the torch for him. You know, his role, as he sees it, is putting pressure on the police, and that is... You know, and telling the facts as he knows it or remembers it.
Yep. And we'll do another 71 episodes, and we'll continue to play our role however it sort of plays out.